killed yesterday. The kingfish took two from the lakeshore Chinooks. The kingfish play in Madison tonight. The forecast from the National Weather Service, partly sunny skies today, a high of 72. Northeast winds at 5 to 10, mostly clear skies this evening, a low of 55. More sunshine tomorrow, warmer, will be pushing 82 in the inland areas. Then for Saturday, a slight chance of some showers and storms in the morning, a better chance for the afternoon with showers and storms considered likely by nightfall. Saturday's high around 78. For Sunday, a 50% chance of additional showers and storms. Sunday's high around 80. Right now, 60. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, I think I have crossed my wires when it comes to today's morning show. I was thinking we were having the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. Looks like that's going to be happening another week instead. In its place, we are going to be replaying an interesting interview out of the archives, which takes us back to Old Salem and the infamous Salem witch trials. By the way, tomorrow on the morning show, a stirring story of real-life heroism, the story of a World War II American pilot who crashed in the Alaskan wilderness and somehow survived for 81 days. Brian Murphy's book is called 81 Days Below Zero. That's tomorrow on the morning show. And you can find the morning show archived at WGTD.org. Click on Talk.
Today's morning show takes you back to the year 1692, to Salem, Massachusetts, and to the infamous chapter of early American history known as the Salem Witch Trials. We do so today courtesy of historian and illustrator Marilyn K. Roach and her fascinating new book, which is called Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and Their Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials. Marilyn K. Roach has chosen to bring alive this shameful history, chapter in our history, by focusing on six specific women, as the title of the book suggests, and they are a mixed group indeed. Some are accused, some are accusers. They are married and single, rich and poor, a slave and free. And as we examine their lives closely and how they each experienced and or participated in these trials, we come to a much richer understanding about how such a terrible thing could befall so many citizens of Salem, Massachusetts. And it's a richly crafted, richly detailed book. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Marilyn K. Roach about her book, which is published by Da Capo Press, again called Six Women of Salem. Marilyn K. Roach, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
I understand that you are a lifelong resident of Massachusetts.
Yes.
I suppose one can't grow up in Massachusetts without knowing something about the Salem witch trials. Can you just kind of give us a sense of how you have come to an increasingly deeper understanding of what happened?
Well, I'd always known about it. Everybody's heard about it, even in other countries. But were a couple of library books that I got out from time to time, and it was a reoccurring interest, but not until the bicentennial of the American Revolution, when a lot of local history was being produced, I came across a guidebook to Salem of 1975, and decided I should go see for myself what it looked like. And I did. It's a train ride away from me. And it was it's a beautiful town. It still is. It has a lot of history other than the witch trials. But I saw a few of the attractions up there, one of them a house that survived from that era. There weren't as many tourist spots up there then as there is now, but some of the presentation that I'd seen didn't quite ring true to what I'd read, and frankly, what I had read at that time wasn't as accurate as what turned up later. But I thought it was worth looking into. Maybe there was a book in it.
Hmm.
27 years later, I got a book on it.
Right. And what you just said prompts me to recall that in your book, you mentioned really more than once the sort of tourist trap economy that has sprung up around Salem and the Salem witch trials. And
Right. Clearly
it's something you are not entirely comfortable with or enthusiastic about. I mean, and I suppose that's one of the reasons why you wanted to write this book.
Well, yeah, they were real people who went through real experiences. It depends. I mean, there's all sorts of presentations. Some in Salem and the area are trying to do the historical aspect of it, put it in context and what we can learn from it. There are actual architectural and artifacts surviving from them, not a lot, but some, you know, history stuff. And the tourist industry has grown a lot in the last few decades. It was a vacuum in the economy, but actually tourists came first before anybody decided that this was a business, because people would show up at an old house that was associated with the witches, like Judge Corwin's surviving house, which looked quite different then than before it was restored, and wanted to see it. And finally, the drugstore owner who had his shop attached to it at that time let people in for a small fee. So and by 1892, the train had come to town decades before that. A newspaper reporter said that a carriage driver he interviewed, which would be like a taxi driver with a horse, said that people would get off the train and the first thing they wanted to see was Hawthorne's birthplace and where the witches were hanged or burned, depending on how inaccurate they were.
Right.
So the tourists came first.
So eventually the tourist attractions rose up, in a sense, to meet the public's insatiable interest in the Salem witch trials.
Yes, some are more accurate than others, not
Right. Naming
names, but some are.
Before we start talking specifically about what your book chronicles, I think our listeners would really find interesting for you to outline how you went about uncovering so much information, often quite detailed information, about especially the lives of these six specific women. What kind of historical record survives in order to yield such a rich treasure trove of information? I mean, a treasure trove which you probably wish was even deeper, but nevertheless is, I think, surprisingly deep and rich.
Yes, because these were ordinary people for the most part. Well, even the rich one. I mean, there wasn't a lot of information recorded about most women anyway, and not a lot about most of the men who lived in those days. Besides the trial papers themselves, which is very good as far as details go, but let's see, general histories of the time to get a feeling of what they were up against, like there was a war going on with Canada. Let's see, there's genealogical information about some of them, certainly the Rebecca Nurse's family and Ann Putnam's family, for that matter. The descendants kept records of things. There's deeds and wills for some of these people. And let's see, other court cases, quarterly court records that have survived, some of which are in print, luckily. Bridget Bishop had been in trouble with neighbors before, not always deservedly. Mary English, although she's the richest woman in Salem, we don't have a record of her actual hearing, unfortunately. But there's a good deal of information that her family kept alive. They weren't going to let it be forgotten that great-grandma was unfairly accused. Not all of it pans out with actually checking the facts, but a lot of it does. And in her case, an actual sampler that she sewed when she was a young girl does survive and is in the Peabody Essex Museum.
Hmm.
So it's neat to see something that was, you know, had personal meaning.
Well, and was held by one of these women.
Yes, indeed.
At one point, I think it's in the preface, you help us understand how we could find out so much about these women, because after all, we're talking about women who lived at a time when women did not have nearly the status or stature of men.
No.
You write at one point, often the known lives of the people around them, such as the more public lives of fathers and husbands,
mm-hmm.
That suggest the quiet world of women's work gave greater hints into their lives. In other words, probably you had to glean from information about these women's husbands and fathers a bit more than survives directly in the public record about they themselves.
Genealogy is a big help. For example, like Ann Putnam's husband was a selectman at various times, held local government things. It's a small village. But if Rebecca's husband is called to serve on a coroner's jury, as he was once, it gives a look into the times. And in fact, that coroner's jury is referenced later in the somebody else's trial. So sometimes there's connections. Lucky for me, not them necessarily. Others were really obscure, like Mary Warren, she's the hired girl for the Proctors. And really, all that's known about her is what is in the witchcraft papers, although she has a great deal to say when she's accusing people. She was accused and an accuser.
Hmm.
But it is enough to get a good story out of it. And with Tituba, let's see,
And Tituba is the slave among these six women.
And, I'm blanking on the name. I'll come up with it. But a scholar examined records in Barbados where she presumably came from and found a similar name in a list of slaves on a particular sugar plantation and tied it possibly with an account of an English slaving expedition to natives in Central America. So this might be the same person. There's a lot of maybes in it. But if it ties together, it makes a story that's likely, I do qualify my remarks, and serve to understand what other people, if not this specific woman, went through. She was definitely not from New England,
though. Right. We should also mention that although your book is scrupulously researched, that there are these brief passages in the book which appear in italicized print,
yes,
in which we are suddenly reading something that is a bit more like fiction than strict fact.
Yeah.
I think it enlivens the book a great deal, and I think it's also good that you make it clear that this is something that the nature of what we're reading at these points in the book, which many of the chapters begin with such a passage. I wonder if you could just say a word about why you wanted to weave those particular passages, somewhat fictionalized, into the fabric of the book.
Well, let's see, frankly, my agent suggested it, but once I tried it out, it seemed to work. I hoped it worked, because I was trying to see the events through the eyes of these six individuals who had quite different views of what was going on and what wasn't going on. And each of those passages are clearly marked as being imaginative, but they're also footnoted, end notes in the back of the book, so that readers can check up on them and see if they interpret it the way I did or not. But the events are so dramatic, it seemed to work. Oh, by the way, the scholar who researched Tituba, her name is Elaine Breslau, just to give her credit.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Marilyn K. Roach. She is the author of a fascinating new book called Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and Their Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials. And I just remembered one other question closely related to the last that I wanted to ask. Obviously, you wanted to give us a sense of this time and place and what unfolded overall in these awful witch trials. But, of course, have chosen to do so through this particular lens of focusing on these six specific women primarily.
Right.
I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your decision to do that as well, because, and I think it works wonderfully, but in the hands of a less able writer, that might have, in a sense, limited the scope of this story and somehow minimized it. I don't think it does in your case, but I just wonder why you thought this was a good idea to approach this kind of sprawling topic in this particular way.
Well, fortunately, there were six that seemed to have such diverse experiences that it helped to summarize what people generally went through, and that there was a certain amount of backstory available for them and for their or for their families, so that it did cover the many aspects of this, because as you said, rich and poor, slave and free, young, old.
I wonder if you could help us set the stage in terms of what New England and particularly Salem, Massachusetts was like in 1690, 1691, and of course particularly 1692, the year of the actual trials. We should mention that your book spends a fair amount of time sort of telling the story of religious persecution and why many of these people found themselves in New England and in this particular community.
Yes, well, they were trying to make a new civilization, not totally new, to found an English civilization the right way, as opposed to what the bishops had made some of them go through back in England. But like the third generation after the original founding. Of course, people came over at different points all along, but the settlements, the towns were established. They weren't facing a wilderness exactly, even if they tended to think of it that way. As I said, there was a war going on with France, and that meant that French Canadian forces and their native allies mounted frontier attacks along the edges of Massachusetts and New Hampshire and Maine, and New York, too. But there were actual raids not that far from Salem Village, anyway. And if it was further north in New Hampshire and Maine, people knew people who lived there and maybe got either killed or kidnapped into Canada and held for ransom. So there was that threat. England had nullified the government of Massachusetts, along with all of the other charter-holding institutions at the return of the king after the Commonwealth period. And Massachusetts, being a bit more contentious than most, eventually there was the Revolution, of course, had a long time getting a charter that would make their government legal again. So they carried on locally, but for several years they couldn't, for example, they couldn't execute anyone even if the courts had tried them. So there were people, not too many, waiting in jail, but it was a reason that the trials were delayed that summer. And they had to rewrite all their laws so that they wouldn't conflict with English law, although that didn't really stop witchcraft prosecutions. There was smallpox now and then, and there was no immunity from that unless you'd survived a case of it. Later, there was inoculation within several decades, but it hadn't happened yet. Privateers would capture people in the fishing fleet. I mean, there was a lot of uncertainty. And added to this, there were neighborhood disagreements as to whether Salem Village, which is the rural part of town, should be its own town, which half of the village wanted and the other half didn't, and Salem itself didn't want any more territory taken away. There was inter-neighborhood squabbles. There was disagreement within the church in Salem Village. And everything, as someone pointed out recently, made a perfect storm of unfortunate circumstances that once there appeared to be witchcraft problems, got really out of hand. And although it started with two young girls acting oddly with something, I really don't know what really started that, but home remedies, they tried that first. That didn't work. They called in doctors, physicians. That didn't work. Nobody could figure it out. They prayed with them and over them. And finally, one of the local physicians said they must be under an evil hand, meaning an evil spell. And once that people started wondering who might be the witch among them, one thing led to another. And once there were arrests, Tituby being one of the first, she was pretty much bullied into a confession and said, in effect, there's others out there. It's not just me. They were trying to hurt me, too. There was even more concern about how many witches are there. Is it a plot? Who do I know hates me? That sort of thing.
Right.
And it spread throughout the region. And, of course, the reason those trials were in Salem was because they were the county seat.
Hmm.
Ordinarily, before this charter business and rewriting the laws, all capital cases, including this one, this type, I mean, would have been tried in Boston, as earlier ones had been.
Hmm.
But there was so much going on that the court was sent to Salem rather than transport all those witnesses and neighbors and bystanders and defendants to Boston. It was easier to send the judges.
Right. Did this end up spreading even beyond Salem? In other words,
yeah.
were there witch trials in other places as well?
Oh, well, there had been witch trials in New Hampshire and Connecticut, a couple of outbreaks in Connecticut earlier than this. Let's see, a few in New York, too. But that 1692, that particular scare, it spread in Massachusetts, eastern Massachusetts, in three counties, say. But there was a flurry of accusations in Connecticut of people who had been suspected before. And although the neighbors down there suspected the accused, the magistrates were seeing what a terrible mess Massachusetts was getting into, and they sort of reined things back, and nobody actually died from that.
Right. And unlike the witch trials in Salem, where ultimately 20 people are executed and 5 die in jail.
Yes.
At some point in your preface, and I wish I could find the moment now, you actually say something, and you're not talking so much about this moment in 1692 in Salem, but just maybe in general, that when an accusation was made about somebody possibly being a witch, engaging in witchcraft, that at least generally speaking, that was a charge that was a serious charge, and generally speaking, it was treated the same way you would treat an accusation that somebody stole money from me or somebody attacked my daughter or whatever. And I think it's important that you made that point and that we mention that now, because I think some of us view this through our own modern-day lens and just think, this is so ridiculous how foolish people could be to recklessly rush to judgment. And of course, to some extent, that is obviously what happened in Salem. But in general, charges of witchcraft were charges that were treated seriously and to whatever extent it's possible, treated intelligently.
Due process. Even in 1692, there was due process, just that they accepted spectral evidence when they shouldn't have. But, yes, and in fact, that's one reason suspicions would sort of simmer around for years, because you didn't want to go to court lightly. And in fact, almost a third of the pre-1692 cases that involved witchcraft charges were slander suits brought by the person who had been accused. against their accuser, and they generally won. Mary English's mother had had to do that with a neighbor who lost her temper big time.
And, of course, that is something we see quite a lot as we explore these stories. All kinds of squabbles between neighbors, between families. At one point, it occurred to me that this appears to have been a very litigious society. That is, if so much of these kind of squabbles endure, survive in the public record, then surely you had a whole lot of neighbors, I mean, sort of bringing charges against one another. In fact, is that the case, or are a lot of these squabbles just squabbles that survive in history because of the trials? Or, in fact, were people, in a sense, invoking law over these kind of disagreements?
Well, there were all kinds of disagreements, but yes, Massachusetts has been called litigious before. In other cases, there were a lot of trespass ones. Usually it's somebody's cows get into the cornfield or the fence is in the wrong place. The survey lines don't match up. And that was a bone of contention a lot. And people, they were able to go to court. And by golly, they took advantage of it when they thought they'd been wronged.
Right. And actually, I'm thinking about a moment with, I believe it might be Rebecca Nurse. Mm-hmm. And something that involved a pig digging up her garden.
Yes.
Tell our listeners what Rebecca Nurse did about that unfortunate turn of events, something which in turn helped lead to her downfall.
Yes, she's usually remembered as a saintly character, but she apparently had a temper at times. Oh, well, pigs can really damage crops. So the Holtons, the neighbor's pigs, get out and they get into her garden. And, I mean, the garden isn't just something you do as a hobby. It's feeding your family, too, and over the winter. And pigs have sharp hooves, and they can really root up stuff. So she and her younger son storm over to the neighbor's house, which still stands, by the way, and confront the Benjamin Holton, I think, or Samuel, well, Mr. Holton. And she's saying the pigs got in the garden, and and if you don't get them out, I'll have my son Daniel here shoot them the next time. Which Holton's wife remembers and relates, at least her version of it, later at the trials, because Mr. Holton, soon after, not immediately after, died of something. And although he didn't accuse anybody at the time, the widow was none too sure about that. And then a couple of years later, when in 1692, she relates this as an example of Rebecca's ill wishes towards them. And what can you expect from someone who threatens to shoot my pigs? And she's telling it as if her husband is absolutely calm and neighborly and forgiving, forbearing through the whole thing. It could have been a sharper argument than that, but this is how she remembers it.
Right.
So Rebecca could get her dander up if necessary.
Right. And, of course, that confrontation is remembered and memories of it evoked at Rebecca's own trial on the charge of being a witch. We've just touched on something that is worth exploring, and that is a theme that occurs again and again, namely sudden and seemingly inexplicable bouts of ill health that will strike down young and old alike. And first of all, it's of course important for us to get a sense of what it was like to live in a time and place when there was really no such thing as medical science in the way we think of it today, and that there was nobody that knew very much at all about how to deal with many illnesses and diseases. And we certainly get the impression that in this time and place, one way that people sort of dealt with such a harsh, capricious reality was to begin making accusations about somebody amongst them causing these terrible things to happen. Can you say a word about that reality and how significant it is in this story?
Well, it's significant in 1692. But people knew that there were natural diseases and that God could send things as punishment too, as well as the devil. But the whole concept of medicine was based on balancing the humors, which isn't what they do in medical school now. And some of the herbal recipes could certainly have worked, but they couldn't cure everything, obviously, and or alleviate everything. They knew that there were natural ills, but if there's other problems going on that don't necessarily get recorded, or, you know, an argument over the pigs, you'd wonder if that had something to do with it, too. There were a number of unexplained deaths, and actually a number of the afflicted people, there were about 70 people who were assumed to have maybe been bewitched into one problem or another. It's not just the girls having convulsions in court, but about several of them died. They actually died from whatever it was that actually was going on. So that just seemed to prove at a really unlucky time that the suspicions were verified.
Mm. You also touched on something earlier in the interview about how part of the fabric of this sort of turbulent little community was squabbles and disagreements within the church.
Yes.
And some of this is particularly interesting and also, I think, largely unknown to most of us who have only the vaguest idea about what unfolded in Salem. But disagreements about, you know, who should be the pastor of what church, and is this person worthy of such an office, and so on. Help us understand what was going on. What sorts of issues were typically the most common sort of fuel for the fire when these kind of disagreements would flare up?
Well, there were problems in other towns, too, but, of course, this one resulted in the witch trials in part. And the records still exist, and there have also been transcribed, so we can actually read them along with the town records. But, let's see, it has to do with the congregational practice of the time where a minister isn't ordained once he finishes his studies. It's when he becomes the minister of a particular congregation or church. Each church is independent. There's no bishops or anything with it. So a town or a village, like Salem Village, would hire someone to be the pastor, but wouldn't necessarily decide right away whether this person would stay permanently or not. Ideally, a minister was supposed to stay permanently with whatever church he becomes the head of. But, you know, human nature being what it is, that didn't always work out. So, let's see, Salem Village had gone through several applicants, and some had been there for years, and then finally they'd ask him if he'd like to stay permanently, and half the town, village would want him, and half the village would say, no, we'd rather wait and see somebody else, and then they'd argue about what they should be paying him per year. And of course the firewood was a big bone of contention because that was the main fuel, and the price of fuel kept going up, and people can identify with that, I think. And it was, you know, not so much theological problems as practical and economic ones, and I think personality clashes, because one of the previous ministers, not ordained to permanently to the place, but in Salem Village, was George Burroughs, who left after having to practically sue to get his money, his back pay, so he could pay his bills. He went off to Maine, and then later he's accused of being the leader of the witches. He's brought back and tried and found guilty, and he's hanged, actually. Mm. So it's not just poor voiceless women who are accused. He died also.
Hmm. It seems to me that one other element in this, what you described earlier as you quoted someone as saying it was kind of a perfect storm,
yes,
of elements which led to such a horrific thing occurring. One element also in this particular time and place and community was sort of the public way in which the criminal justice system, such as it was, played out. And I mean, in a way that's just not the case today. I mean, that so much of the turning of the wheels of justice occurs behind relatively closed doors in relatively private fashion. And so much of these kind of events, even I don't even mean the witch trials, played out very much in public. For instance, I wonder if you'd be willing to tell our listeners about what befell Bridget Bishop at one point in her life. I don't remember if she was Bridget Bishop at that time, but
Bridget Oliver.
But where she was, she was a lively woman, cantankerous, and maybe living in an abusive marriage, and she and her husband Thomas, I believe, were sentenced in a very, very public way that for us now would strike us as very strange. But the more we know about Salem in the 17th century, it seems to make sense. Can you tell our listeners about that moment?
Well, of course, this is traditional English practice of the time. It's not just invented in New England.
Right.
But, yes, her second husband slapped her around, apparently. He'd had a rather difficult first wife, too. I don't know what she and he did in that direction, but he hit Bridget. And some neighbors testified when this came to the magistrate's attention that she called them over to witness that he'd hit her, and actually he called some neighbors over at a time to say how difficult she was, but she hit him back. That was rather satisfying to read, that she defended herself. So because they were, and one time it escalated to them yelling at each other in public, and she called them an old rogue and an old devil. Now, of course, that's like saying you're in league with the devil, which is, of course, a hanging offense, so you don't bandy it around, but she was really angry at him. And the two of them, because they had been quarreling in public and on the Sabbath, too, it must have been interesting to observe that, they were sentenced to stand in the public marketplace on one of the market days so that there'd be, you know, people around to watch and wear a sign saying that they had done that, but or pay a fine. And Thomas's daughter from his previous marriage paid the fine for her father, leaving Bridget to stand in the marketplace with this sign on it pinned to her clothes for so long and get stared at by the public, which could not have pleased her at all, but it made an interesting episode to describe.
Right. And, of course, if we are in a time and place where such a thing is done, that somehow that helps us understand how there could be, in a sense, not only an openness to, but almost even a hunger for something like the spectacle of the Salem witch trials.
Oh, well, yes. Lurid headlines and that sort of thing. It's not something that was invented recently.
Hmm. We're speaking with Marilyn K. Roach, author of Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused. And, of course, we're going to ultimately leave it to our listeners to read your book for the painstaking blow-by-blow account of what unfolded in these trials. But if we could just take a couple minutes to just outline kind of the basics. Tell us at what point these proceedings began to occur. What was the single catalyst that set all of this in motion?
Well, the catalyst would be the illnesses of the daughter and niece of the minister in Salem Village, Samuel Parris, his daughter Betty, and his niece Abigail Williams, who was part of the household. They were the ones that the home remedies didn't work, and the doctor said they were probably under an evil hand. And let's see, one day when the minister and his wife were out, a neighbor, who was an English, white, free, respectable church member, she comes over and suggests to Tituba that they try it's an anti-magic charm, actually, of making a witch cake that will reveal who the persecuting witch is. You take a bit of the urine of the afflicted person and mix it up with some cheap rye meal, bake it in the ashes, and feed it to the dog. And this is supposed to hurt the part of the witch that is magically gotten into the person. It's sympathetic magic. But anyway, it's supposed to reveal the witch. And it didn't. But I'm sure the girls had heard that the adults suspected this, and by golly, is that what's happening to them? So it doesn't reveal anybody, but they just get worse, and they start seeing things. So the first three people who are accused, or are whether they meant to accuse Tituba or not, she had done this little bit of magic, and this is the only magic that can be associated with her, and that was at the neighbor's suggestion. Now, later, Mary Sibley is taken to task for this, but nobody accuses her of anything. But by the time Tituba and two other local women are arrested and questioned in a hearing, this is March 1st of 1692, Tituba's backed into a corner, in effect, and more or less confesses. She's been trying to say all along, no, the witches have been persecuting me too, but the magistrates have their minds made up. So she says, in effect, there are other witches out there, and then people start thinking about everybody else they never trusted, including Rebecca Nurse. It's hard to know why, except for the pig episode, and another woman in the neighborhood, and each time someone's arrested, it gets worse and worse, although Rebecca and several other people, they didn't confess at all. They gave reasons as to why you couldn't trust what they thought they saw, even if they really thought they saw it. So it goes from one set of suspicions to another, the jails fill up because they can't try anybody for a capital case until they get the new charter, which is in June, and can reestablish a government.
Hmm.
So in order to clear the jails, they have the special court of oyer and terminer that go to Salem and try people. And surprise, everybody who was tried that summer is found guilty.
And you describe an atmosphere which seems to not only be one of hysteria, which is, I think, usually what we think of. It's just a bunch of people that just get worked up about nothing, and the next thing you know, you're hysterical. But we get a sense of even desperation that at least in the minds of some. There are some where this seems almost cold and calculating, mm-hmm. a very self-serving thing to do on behalf of their own family against others. But then there are others for whom they are really caught up in what seems like desperation to save their community and the people they love.
Yeah. I suspect that there were a variety of reasons why people did what they did, and I think some of them talked themselves into believing what they said for at least a while. But after a time, if they took a closer look at what was happening, they could just pull back from the panic and see that it wasn't what they had thought. It was rather dangerous to admit that, as Mary Warren found out, because then others would wonder if you had joined the devil's side, which supposedly the spectral witches were enticing people to do.
Hmm. Describe to our listeners how these trials would differ from our notion now of what happens at a trial. There are obviously certain elements that would look a little bit familiar, but of course, in many other ways, these trials did not proceed the way modern-day trials proceed.
Well, they don't allow spectral evidence anymore. Well, we hope. The dialogue that's been preserved, the questions and answers, is from the hearing, which would be sent on to the grand jury, and there were grand juries. We just don't have their records, except briefly, with some of the later ones. Later trials. And if the grand jury thought that there was something there to send to a trial jury, then they would do that, and the trial jury would examine the evidence, such as it was, and come to a verdict. But what was really different about the Salem trials that had not been typical with other witch trials in New England was the presence of the supposed afflicted witnesses who were being, they said, attacked by evil spirits in the courtroom, as well as at other places and other times throughout this several months. So they would be convulsing and strangling and turning blue in the face in front of the court, the judges, the jury, bystanders, and it must have been convincing, even I think some of them eventually added to that, but I think they were convinced most of them, at least for a good long time, that they really were being attacked, and it became a self-fulfilling prophecy because they're panicked and things are going wrong. But that was the really unusual part. And once spectral evidence was no longer allowed, and people like Cotton Mather advised against using spectral evidence because you can't trust what the devil's delusions might be, and several of the accused pointed that out too, but no one was listening to them. But by the end of the summer, September was particularly awful, and in October things stopped. They just stopped things for a while until England could advise them. Actually, England didn't advise them until after they started up again without spectral evidence the following winter. Only three people were found guilty in Salem's trials then for Essex County, and they did survive. And for two other counties, nobody was found guilty. Without spectral evidence, you just couldn't prove it.
Hmm. It's a sad chapter in our early history, and I think you underscore this in the way you lay out the book, not only by spelling out the early lives of these six women to the best of your ability, but then very detailed account of what unfolded in the trial itself, what it was like to be a witness or participant. And then you devote a considerable amount of time to the aftermath, to what occurred for those who survived, for those who did not survive, what occurred with their loved ones and so on, and kind of the lasting legacy of all that. It seems to me that that's a part of this story that has really been largely neglected until now.
Because some families, it seemed they didn't want to talk about it, but others would not let the injustice drop, like Rebecca Nurse's family and some of the others. In fact, Reverend Burroughs, who's not one of the six women, obviously, but his descendants were suing into the third generation trying to get reparations, and the only thing that really stopped them was the American Revolution breaking out and other matters occupying the government. But yes, some families preserved stories of what had happened, some more accurate than others, and others just seemed to disappear afterwards.
I know that in the end, what you were most anxious about is that these six women in particular, but also all the others caught up in this awful vortex, would be remembered as vibrant, unique human beings,
yeah,
and not just as names in a textbook or a history book. After having finally completed this book, do you feel like you have managed to accomplish that, at least to some extent?
Well, I hope I have, because showing other parts of their life would help, I hope, to show that these are actual individuals and that this isn't some Halloween game. It's something that people live through. And everybody's got a story, and some are more tragic than others.
Absolutely. Well, for me at least, these women live vibrantly in a way that that they never had before, and it helps me look back at this moment in history in a very, very different way, and I know it will be that way for our listeners who seek out your book. Once again, the book is Six Women of Salem, The Untold Story of the Accused and Their Accusers in the Salem Witch Trials, published by Da Capo Press. Marilyn K. Roach, congratulations on a very, very fine book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you.
And tomorrow in the morning show, an almost unbelievable tale of survival in the Alaskan wilderness with Brian Murphy, the author of 81 Days Below Zero. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities available at carthage.edu. We're about to join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming, and Dave Cole will be back at 12 noon to update you on all of the latest news events on WGTD's Midday Report. For more information about WGTD's programming, you can go to our website, which is wgtd.org. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine,